Welcome to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm your host, Chase Maxwell. Twenty-one years ago, the Friends began a storytelling series for adults. What could be better than sitting by the fire, sipping a hot cup of coffee or cider, while listening to some of the best writers Minnesota has to offer? Over the years, the Fireside series has featured a great range of authors, from Kate DiCamillo to Jack Weatherford, Carol Bly to Jack Elhai, making the winter just that much more bearable. The 2015 lineup is no exception. Well, there actually is one exception, and you're listening to it. For over 20 years, the Fireside series has drawn enthusiastic crowds to the beautiful, but small, Hamlin Midway Library, and this is one way we're celebrating that legacy, by broadcasting the entire season and reaching a larger audience. Episode 5 features writer Alan Eskins adding some literary chills to the series when he reads from his twisting and evocative mystery, The Life We Bury, called a masterful debut in a starred review by Publishers Weekly. When college student Joe Talbert's writing assignment introduces him to a convicted murderer, he has no idea it will send him tumbling into the heart of a 30-year-old mystery that will threaten to end his life. In addition to his writing life, Eskins is a criminal defense attorney with over 20 years' experience. He graduated with a Bachelor's of Arts in Journalism from the University of Minnesota and a Juris Doctorate from Hamlin University School of Law. The Life We Bury is his first book and a finalist in the genre fiction category of the Minnesota Book Awards. So sit back, hopefully with a hot cup of cider in hand, and get ready to be transported.
Good evening. Thank you for coming out on such a cold night. If you guys want to sit by the fire, feel free. It's nice. When I've gone to readings and events for other authors, I hear them talk about the path that they took to become a writer. And so when I wrote my first novel, I thought that's what I would talk about as well. And what I hear a lot of other authors talk about is things like, you know, they knew from an early age they were going to be a writer. They spent a lot of time in libraries. They, you know, their parents were teachers. They wrote their first, you know, short story in third grade, that kind of thing. And I listen to them and I think, that's not me. I was not the kind of person who thought from a young age I would ever be a writer. In fact, I wasn't the kind of person who thought that I would do anything beyond 12th grade. I thought once I graduated my senior year, I was done with school, and I wasn't a very good student. And this came to light my very first year, when I was in first grade. My report card, I brought it with me actually, this is my actual first grade report card. There was no place for comments, but my teacher, Sister Ronald Marie, put where my parents were supposed to sign a little note. And it reads, "Alan dreams too much when work needs to be done in class." It comes back around. And my story is kind of the story of how teachers have moved me from my initial goal of just getting out of school to going on to college and law school and now being a writer. Do we have any teachers or retired teachers in the audience today? Well, this is a first.
I have. I graduated from college to be a teacher, but when I did my student teaching, it was so painfully hard. My comment to everyone is, pay them whatever they want because it's a terrible job. It's so hard.
And I'm the kind of student that made it even harder. I truly am. Over the course of my 12 years, mostly my first 8 years, that notion of I daydream too much made it onto most of my report cards. It made it into most of my parent-teacher conferences. you know, some form. Alan's easily distracted. He doesn't pay attention in class. He daydreams. The teachers used to assign me a seat away from the window because if I was near the window, I'd look out, and I grew up in Missouri. Nice warm summer breeze or fall breeze would be coming in, and I was gone. By the time I got into eighth grade, though, the teachers, it wasn't as cute to them anymore as it was in first grade. I brought my actual eighth grade report card. And this is from Mrs. Lee. Mrs. Lee was my eighth grade language arts teacher. Think about that. I make a living now with language arts. And this is what Mrs. Lee thought of my language arts skills. Alan is completely out of it in language arts. He seldom pays attention. He seldom studies. He seldom does the work. And when he does, it's not of the quality he's capable of doing. Signed, Mrs. Lee. And she had a point. I mean, but when I was in eighth grade, I really didn't plan to go to college. So to me, I didn't need to know grammatical issues. I was going to be in construction. My dad owned a drywall company. That was where my path was leading me. But like I said, teachers changed that. And the first teacher to change it was my fifth grade teacher. When I was in fifth grade, I was a bit of a, not class clown, but I did act out quite a bit. And Mrs. Allen, my fifth grade teacher, saw something in me that no one else had seen before. That year, my school put on a play. Now, it's first through eighth grade. In order to be in this play, you had to be sixth, seventh, or eighth grade, and I was a fifth grader. I didn't even know the play was going to happen. But Mrs. Allen went to the director, the eighth grade teacher, and asked if I could have an audition. And she talked him into letting me audition for this play, a play that I didn't even know was going on. And so I auditioned, and I got the best role in the whole play, not the lead. And it was a Catholic school, by the way. I got the only character who said a cuss word in the entire play. And I can still remember, I was sitting backwards on a chair, and I'm looking out over the audience, and this priest is standing behind me, and he's trying to get me to confess my sins before they hang me. And he says, "Are you sure you don't want to confess?" I say, "Yes, I'm sure. Damn it, go away." Yeah. And the first performance was for grades 1 through 4. And when I said that line, I'm looking out over the audience, and these little kids, their eyes pop, their jaws drop. It's like, oh, he said a cuss word. And I became a minor celebrity. And I thought, I like this theater thing. It's kind of fun. Well, my school had no more plays. So that was the only one that they did that. And so 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, no more theater. But when I got into high school, I was having lunch with my best friend. And by the time I was in high school, I had not only decided I was just going to get out of senior year and go home, I was not going to do anything. I wasn't going to go out for any sports, anything. And it was spring semester, so I'd made it through the entire fall without doing any extracurricular whatsoever. And this guy was bragging about this spring play he was going to be in. And I was going to get this wonderful role. And me and my buddy are sitting there listening to him, thinking, you know, this guy's full of crap. And so my buddy and I dared each other to try out for the school play. And I had remembered how much fun I had when I was in fifth grade. And so we tried out, and we both got in the chorus, but Oklahoma, yay. So I went out for theater. And it was that dare that got me rolling down a different path because I really, again, enjoyed doing theater. Like I told you before, my dad owned a drywall company. Everybody I knew did construction. My friends were all friends of, you know, my dad's construction buddies. And so we never talked about college. It never came up. It was never something that I'd planned to do. But now that I was in theater, I was hanging out with kids who come from a different background, and they were talking about going to college. I still didn't think I had what it took. So I listened to them. You know, I enjoyed doing theater. And taking the theater classes, I got A's in my course, in my theater, in those classes, which was important because I was getting D's and F's and C's and everything else. I flunked algebra, Spanish. I got D's in typing. Now I write for a living. Accounting, English lit. So I still wasn't trying very hard, but I was getting grades good grades in my theater classes. And around my junior year, something else happened that changed my life. And I didn't realize it at the time. I wouldn't realize it for years later. But I was required in one of my classes to write a short story. And I'd never written a short story before. I didn't know anything about writing short stories. So I just took one of my daydreams and I wrote it out. Now, I was the kind of kid who always turned my homework in late because I procrastinated, I didn't want to do it, and like Mrs. Lee said, it was always subpar. But with this story, there was something about that. I enjoyed writing this daydream onto paper. I really did. And I turned it in a day late, not because I procrastinated, but because I couldn't stop writing it. I had a short story that was twice as long as what was required for that class. And I even drew a cover for it. And I put Reader's Digest condensed version on the top. And I turned it in, and when I got it back, I got an A, which was unusual for an English class for me. But as I was leaving the classroom that day, my teacher pulled me aside and said, "Have you ever thought about writing to get published?" Now again, I'm not that person yet. And I'm the kid who's smoking cigarettes in the alley before he comes to school still. And I just kind of sloughed it off and said, "No, I'm not that kind of person," and I walked out. But her words stayed with me. I remember walking down the hallway thinking, writing to get published, what does that even mean? And I planted that in the back of my head, and it became a seed that would later grow the fruit of this novel. So I'm going through high school, and some of my friends are going to college, and so I decide I'm going to give it a shot. What the heck? I apply, I'm accepted, I go to the University of Iowa. My thought is, I'll go there, avoid life for 4 more years, do theater, then go back and hang sheetrock if I need to. And when I got into college, I realized that I had other abilities. It wasn't just theater. I was getting decent grades in other classes that in high school I did very poorly in. And there was this wonderful smorgasbord of knowledge at college that I didn't know existed. You could open up a catalog, point to a class, and study whatever your finger lands on. You know, I was studying French architecture. I studied Hinduism. Just whatever struck my fancy, I could study it. And I was learning. It was fun. And so I decided not to graduate with a theater major because there were other things that I was learning to do, and one of them was journalism. So I switched my degree to journalism. I transferred to the University of Minnesota, where I finished my degree. Got a degree in journalism, and thought, why stop now? I mean, there's this wonderful law school here in town. So I applied to law school here at Hamline and got accepted. And I decided in college, I didn't actually try that hard the first couple years because, again, I was just going to do my 4 years and get out. When I got to law school, I was set. I was going to study hard. I was going to really try this time. And I was very focused. And in fact, when I was going to law school here, I lived one block across on Minnehaha. If you actually counted the hours I lived at the law school and just slept at Minnehaha, but I ate, slept, breathed law school. I loved it. But I still had this seed in the back of my head saying, okay, you become a lawyer, but you still have this creative side that you need to feed somehow. What about Mrs. Lubring's statement about writing? Maybe you can write to get published. So I had it kind of sitting back there as an idea, because I wanted to be able to express myself creatively, and you really can't do that as an attorney very well. And when I was at law school, I was on this moot court team, the Jessup International Moot Court Competition. And what it is it's 4 students, 2 on one side, 2 on the other. They write appellate briefs, and they submit them into a contest, and they're judged. And our brief won best brief in the regional competition, which was exciting. But then it went on to the national competition, and our brief competed against all the other regional winners throughout the country, and our brief won best brief in the nation. But this is the Jessup International Moot Court Competition. So after we won best brief in the nation, it goes to The Hague, where our brief competed with all the other country winners. Little Hamline University, our brief won best brief in the world that year. And when my professor came to me to tell me this news, the first thought that popped into my head wasn't, I'm going to be a rich international attorney. The first thought that popped into my head was, I can write a novel. And it was that strange. It was like, I can write a novel. Wait, what am I thinking? Because I always had this doubt in my head, you know, about the ability to write a novel. It's something that most people, you don't think I can do that. It's just something that is so far out there. But I thought, if I can learn how to write well enough to do a brief in law school that can win that kind of award, I should be able to learn how to write a novel. So that's the day that I knew that I would someday, if I lived long enough, write a novel. And so I graduated from law school, got a job in St. Peter as a prosecutor, and I had time on my hands, so I started writing just for the fun of it and realized I didn't know how to write because I had studied journalism, which is inverted pyramid writing. I studied law school, which is IRAC form of writing, but creative writing is a whole different beast. So I started reading books on how to write. How do you tell a good sentence from a bad sentence, a good paragraph from a bad paragraph? And when I felt the books had done as much as they could, I started taking classes at the Loft. The University of Iowa has a summer writing program that I would go down to. Minnesota State University, I entered their MFA program. And there I met a wonderful teacher, Terry Davis, who wrote A Vision Quest. It got made into a movie back in the 80s. And he said something to me that I still remember to this day. He goes, you don't just want to tell a story. You want to evoke emotion when you write. That's always the goal. You don't always reach that goal, but you try for it. That's what you shoot for. So in telling a story, you're trying to evoke emotion from your reader, get them to identify with your characters enough so that when something good or bad happens to the character, the reader feels it. And so that's always been something that I've been trying to do when I write. So I studied off and on for 20 years, and when I felt that I had acquired enough knowledge, I decided it was time to write a novel. Now, I have another manuscript at home that I'd never sent out to get published. It's what I call my working manuscript. So over the 20 years while I'm studying writing, I was practicing in this manuscript. So if I learned something about pacing, I would go and write a chapter about pacing or dialogue, I'd do that. So this is actually my first attempt. I'm going to write a novel and try and get it published. So I sat down, outlined The Life We Bury, wrote it in 2011, and got an agent, got a publisher, and now it came out in 2014, in October. It's doing quite well. I'm very pleased with it. It's getting some attention. It's getting, you know, people are writing me emails, which is really unusual, you know, writing me emails saying, I loved your book. I've gotten some good reviews, but I really love getting the emails. That's really cool, because it's, you know, these are people who have to go out and try and find me, you know, through my website, and just let me know what they thought of my book, and I just love that. But what I want to do now is read a small section from the novel, and then I'm going to open it up for discussion, questions. I'd love to answer any questions you may have, so while I'm reading, think of them. Now, I'm reading from chapter 6, and the story is about Joe Talbert, who is a student at the University of Minnesota, and he gets this assignment to go interview somebody and write their story. And I actually had that assignment when I was in college. That's where the seed of this novel came from. I thought, what if I'd gone, I went to a nursing home to try and find somebody because I wasn't from this state. And I just asked, is there anybody here who'd be willing to do this project with me? And so when I was trying to come up with an idea for a novel, that's where it started. What if I'd gone to that nursing home and met somebody with a dark secret, you know, a dark past? You know, how would that have changed my life and my assignment? So Joe goes to this nursing home, and there he meets Carl Iverson. Carl Iverson he's been paroled from prison after spending 30 years locked up for murder. He's dying of pancreatic cancer, and so they wanted him to die in a nursing home as opposed to in prison, so they paroled him. And Joe decides he's going to do Carl's story. And Carl tells him, you know, his story. And during the course of that interviewing and that discussion, it draws Joe into this 30-year-old mystery. Joe begins to doubt the veracity of this conviction. Now, there's another part to the story, which is that Joe kind of ran away from home to go to college. He was raised in Austin, Minnesota, and he left behind a dysfunctional mother, a woman who has some bipolar issues and some alcohol issues, but he also left behind his autistic younger brother, Jeremy. Jeremy's 18. And for most of his life, Joe has taken care of Jeremy. Joe's 21. And they have a very close bond. But Joe wants to live his own life. And that's why he runs away from home to go to college, is he wants to have that fresh start where he's not responsible for his brother. But during the course of the novel, he keeps getting pulled back to Austin to deal with situations. And during the course of the novel, he has to resolve that issue. So in chapter 6, where I pick up, Joe has just met face-to-face with Carl for the first time. And Carl, who, like I said, is dying of cancer, was a little more spunky than Joe was expecting. And Carl kind of insults Joe, you know, calls him a rich college kid. And that makes Joe angry, and that's where I pick up. The vigor of this emaciated old man caught me off guard, and frankly, it pissed me off. I thought about Jeremy back in my apartment, a TV remote click away from crisis. I thought about my mother in jail, begging for my help on the inhale and cursing my birth on the exhale. I thought about the thin edge that I walked between being able to afford college and not, and I wanted to dump that dusty, judgmental prick out of his wheelchair. I felt anger rising in my chest, but I took a deep breath, as I'd learned to do whenever I became frustrated with Jeremy, and I let it pass. "You know nothing about me," I said. "You don't know where I've been, what I've had to deal with. You don't know the shit I've had to wade through to get here. Whether or not you tell me your story is up to you. That's your prerogative. But don't presume to judge me." I fought against the urge to stand up and walk out, holding onto the arms of the chair to keep me in my seat. Iverson glanced down at my white-knuckled grip, then at my eyes. A hint of a smile, more subtle than a snowflake, crossed his face, and his eyes nodded approval. "That's good," he said. "What's good?" "That you understand how wrong it is to judge someone before you know the whole story." I saw the lesson he wanted me to learn, but I was far too angry to respond. He continued. "I could have told my story to any number of people. I used to get letters in prison from people wanting to turn my life into something they can make money from. I never responded, because I knew I could give 100 authors the same information and they would write 100 different stories. So if I'm going to tell you my story, if I tell you the truth about everything, then I need to know who you are, that you're not just some punk in this for an easy grade, that you'll be honest with me and fair about how you tell my story." "You understand," I said, "this is just a homework assignment. No one's going to read it except my teacher." "Do you know how many hours there are in a month?" Carl asked, apropos of nothing. "I'm sure I could figure it out." "There's 720 hours in the month of November. October and December each have 744. "Okay," I said, hoping he would explain his tangent. "You see, Joe, I can count my life in hours. If I'm going to spend some of those hours on you, I need to know that you're worth my time." I hadn't considered that point. Janet thought Carl would be dead by Christmas. With just a week remaining in September, that would give Carl 3 months to live. I did the rough math in my head and understood. If Janet was right, then Carl Iverson had less than 3,000 hours of life left to live. "I guess that makes sense," I said. "So what I'm saying is this. I'll be truthful with you. I'll answer any question you put to me. I'll be that proverbial open book. But I need to know that you're not wasting my limited time. You have to be honest with me as well. That's all I ask. Can you do that?" I thought for a moment. "You'll be absolutely honest about everything?" "Absolutely honest." Carl held out his hand to shake mine, to seal the agreement. I took it. I could feel the bones of Carl's hands knocking around under his thin skin as if I were gripping a bag of marbles. "So, Mr. Iverson, let me ask you a question." "Go ahead." "Because you only have a few months to live, why would you agree to spend that time talking to me?" Carl adjusted himself in his chair, gazing out the window at the drying towels and the barbecue grills littering the apartment balconies across the way. I could see his index finger stroking the arm of his wheelchair. It reminded me of how Jeremy strokes his knuckles when he's anxious. Joe, he said finally, do you know what a dying declaration is? I didn't, although I gave it a shot. It's a declaration made by someone who's dying? It's a term of law, he said. If a man whispers the name of his killer and then dies, it's considered good evidence because there's a belief, an understanding, that a person who is dying would not want to die with a lie upon his lips. No sin can be greater than the sin that cannot be rectified, the sin you can never get to confess. So this conversation with you, this is my dying declaration. I don't care if anybody reads what you write. I don't even care if you write it down. Carl pursed his lips, his stare searching for something beyond the immediate scenery, a slight quiver in his words. I have to say the words out loud. I have to tell someone the truth about what happened all those years ago. I have to tell someone the truth about what I did.
One of the best parts of the Fireside series, the Q&A with the author and our dedicated audience. It's a chance to go beyond the book, connecting readers and writers on a deeper level. To make it easier for you, the listener, I've summarized the questions and we'll read them. First up, an audience member asks about profanity in Eskin's writing. Does he ever worry about offending his audience now or in the future?
You do think about that. I try to limit it to where I think it is appropriate. If I, as a 21-year-old in that situation, would have used that language, I think there's an honesty that requires me to use that language sometimes. I know that times have changed. I think Mark Twain once said, if you want to edit your story down, put a cuss word in place of every, and I can't remember which word it was, and your editor will take it out for you. because back then, you couldn't put any cuss words in your novels. But like I said, times have changed. There, you know, language is seen a little more liberally nowadays in terms of if it's something that is said in society, it should be something that is found in novels. So I try and be judicious about it and not overuse it. And I guess it's in the eye of the reader as to whether or not I use it too much or too little.
Next up, an audience member asks if Eskin is a fan of other authors in his genre and if he's an active reader.
I do read in this genre. I am still not a good reader. I'm a writer, but I don't read as much or as fast as I wish I could. It's kind of odd to say that, but I can remember in first grade standing up and having to read out loud and how terrified I was of that. Because reading out loud just scared me and I was very slow at it. And I've heard that people read differently. Some people look at words and the images and stuff come to them without them having to say it in their head. I'm one of those people that when I read, I have to hear it in my head. I have to hear the words being spoken in my head. So I read really slowly. What I've done though is libraries are a wonderful source of books on CD. And in my law practice, in Mankato, but I go to court in Waseca, in New Ulm, Fairmont. And so there's a good bit of driving time in my practice. So I get these books on CD and I listen, which I consider almost reading. So I usually have one novel that I have in my truck at any time that I'm listening to. And then I have one that's by my bedstand that I read. But the problem is the one by my bedstand, when I start reading it, if it's a good book, it makes me want to write. So I'll read a few pages and go, oh, that sounds great. I want to do that. So, you know, I put the book down, and I'll start writing, and then those ones in my bedstand take forever to get through because I'm always, you know, jumping into the computer to do some typing. But I love when I went to the University of Iowa for a summer writers program one time, there was a guy giving a presentation on mystery writers. And I, being a criminal defense attorney, thought that'd be a perfect fit for me. And he talked about, he actually drew this diagram, you know, by this page, you gotta have this happen. By this page, this has to happen. You know, by 3/4 of the way through, your hero has to have a setback. And it was very formulaic. And I walked out of that class thinking, I'm never going to write a mystery, because I was completely unimpressed with having to write formulas. And back in the 70s and 80s, that was how a lot of writers wrote. It was, you know, formulaic. But there are authors out there now who are very excellent literary writers who write mysteries. Joyce Carol Oates, Dennis Lehane is my favorite. If you've ever read Dennis Lehane, Mystic River, it is brilliant, and it is a mystery, but it's really a character study. It's a story of these three boys and how they are when they're grown up. In my own mind, how I envision when I'm outlining a novel is there's two basic plots. There's the external plot, and then there's the internal plot. The external plot is the mystery. Is the mystery going to get solved? The internal plot is, you know, are the brothers going to get together in the end? Are the guy and the girl going to get together in the end? You know, is this personal journey that the protagonist goes through, is that going to come to fruition? And when I wrote The Life We Bury, I used that external plot in my own mind as a vehicle. That's going to pull people forward, because, you know, they're going to want to know, does the crime get solved? Does the mystery get solved? But the internal plot, I believe, is what pulls people deeper into the story. And when I outlined it, I actually had two different outlines. Here's the vehicle plot, the mystery. Here's how it gets, you know, developed. And then there's a second plot. Here's the relationship between the brothers, and here's what happens with that. And I sat back and just kind of said, okay, let's put this first, second, third, and just put these in order. And it took a lot of work to mesh them together so they fit well together. But that's how I view, you know, mysteries now. I think more writers are writing mysteries in terms of the characters. And the mystery is there to be solved, but the characters are there to make you feel for them and to make you think and evoke emotion. So that's hopefully what I can do with my writing. That's what I'm trying to do. But that's what some of the great writers like Dennis Lehane can do, and I really appreciate his writing.
The next question is about one of the main characters in the novel. The protagonist, Joe, has a brother with autism. Was this character inspired by anyone in Eskin's life? The audience member also compliments Eskin's on the novel's title.
No, the character of Jeremy does have a, there's a person in my life that is kind of a guide for me on that. I don't want to talk about specifically who that is, because I don't want to shine a light on him. But the mannerisms, the speech, the how they act, that's very authentic because this person's in my life. So I did know that aspect of the story. On your first, the title, you can thank my agent for the title, because my original title was A Dying Declaration, which I took from that chapter I just read. My thought was, I'll have like legal titles for all my novels, and that would be my brand. And she read the novel and said, you know, this isn't really a legal novel. It's a literary novel. You need a more literary title. And so I sat there, and it took me a couple of weeks, and I was thinking, okay, what are the themes? The themes, what are the themes? And that theme just kept coming to me in different forms. So that's where the title came from, is, you know, all these people are trying to leave stuff behind.
Next up, an audience member asked about adapting The Life We Bury for the big screen. Does Eskins have an actor in mind to play the part of Joe Talbert?
I believe that this novel could be turned into a screenplay. I don't know that I want to do it, because I don't have that experience. I studied, like I said, for 20 years on writing a novel. I think there are people out there who have excellent experience writing screenplays, and they could do a much better job than I could. I do have some ideas that I'd like to give them, say, you know, there's certain scenes that I think that could play a certain way in the movie that don't play that same way in the novel. But as far as the characters, I'm almost afraid to say, because if I say, then people who haven't read it will have that image in their head. But yeah, I do have, in my own head, Joe, no, I don't have anybody in particular in mind who I would think would play Joe, just because I don't know those 21-year-old actors anymore. Or Lila, who's the female character. But Carl, you know, Billy Bob Thornton, that's who I envisioned when I was, you know, writing Carl, is Billy Bob Thornton without the Southern accent. So.
Following that question, an audience member asked if Eskins ever sent a copy of his novel to his former school teacher, Mrs. Lee.
Not Mrs. Lee, but Mrs. Pardon me? Mrs. Lee was my 8th grade teacher who said that I was very bad at her class. Yeah, Mrs. Allen, my 5th grade teacher who got me into the play, I sent her a copy, signed copy. And Mrs. Lubring, who was the junior, my junior class, who said, have you ever thought about writing to get published? I had to track her down. She had married, and it took a while to find her, but I found her and tracked her down and sent her a copy, and we've been emailing since then, so it was really nice. To Mrs. Lee, I actually tried to look her up, but with that name, there's so many of them. So I'd have to go back to my old high school, my old grade school in St. Peter in Jefferson City, Missouri, to see if I could find out where she moved to from there. But I have no idea where to begin looking for her. It would be nice. I did, do a quick search online, but it was just there's so many Mrs. Lees out there, and I don't remember her first name even.
The next question is about a sequel to Eskin's debut novel. Does he have a follow-up novel in the works?
Yes. Novel number two. I've actually completed novel number two. It is at the publisher's, getting edited. It is not yet titled. The title that I had was not as literary as they would like, so we're discussing different options for titles, and we'll probably have one sometime in April, I think, is when they're planning to get together and have a drop dead date for the title. But what I did was the characters in this, Joe's a college student. I'm not a big fan of having an amateur sleuth constantly stumbling over dead bodies. And so I thought I'm not gonna go and have Joe have another mystery because he's in college, let him finish college. And so in his adventure, he elicits the help of a homicide detective. And because Carl Iverson was convicted of this murder, the homicide detective really doesn't want to get involved because it's a closed case. Why deal with it? But then he sends him to Hamline University, where the head of the Innocence Project has an office. His name is Bodie Sandin. So the cop, Max Rupert, and Bodie Sandin are going to be characters in the next novels. I've got a contract for 3 more novels, and that's going to be a story arc that primarily deals with Max Rupert, the homicide detective. When that's done, then I'm going to go back and do something with Bodie. And then by then, Joe's going to be graduated.
He'll be all set.
Yeah. So he'll be a reporter, I think. He's a journalism major, so he'll probably be working for Associated Press. But I have some ideas for his next book, but that's, a lot of books away, and I have a lot of writing to do, and I have the day job as the lawyer, which takes little time away from my writing, so.
Next up, an audience member asked if it was difficult for Eskins to find an agent. How was the experience of finding an agent?
It was not easy. You send out these query letters, and you say, hey, look at me, I wrote a novel, please be interested. And then you hear nothing. And you wait weeks and weeks and you hear nothing more. I had a list of 175 agents that I was going to submit to. If I didn't find an agent by the end of that list, I was going to put this novel aside. I was already writing novel number two. So I was going to, try and get an agent with novel number two, then go back and say, oh yeah, by the way, I got this other novel. But lucky 151. I was at 151, and my agent said, I like your style, don't like the title. So she sent me some ideas for revisions. I did the revisions. She signed me up as a client, and if she ever quit agenting, I would be at her door knocking on it and begging her to keep agenting me, because she's wonderful. She is a magazine, or is a former magazine editor, so she has a wonderful eye towards editing. Also, she's very good conceptually on the big things. So she was very helpful in getting The Life We Bury into final form before sending it on to a publisher. Once she and I were finished with the edits that she had ideas for, it didn't take long to get a publisher. We sent it to 8 publishers, got four requests for manuscripts within a week, and within 2 weeks we had two offers. So it moved quite quickly after that.
Following that question, the same audience member asked if Eskin's publisher made many changes to the manuscript.
He did not. Now, my publishing editor made some, you know, small changes here and there, but nothing major. Nothing like my agent did. Well, the book had a prologue to begin with, and she goes, no prologue. I said, well, really? I love the prologue. No prologue. Okay. But I agree, looking back now, it was a good idea. She had a better idea than I did, and she saw it. You know, the prologue was a different voice. It was third person, where the rest of the novel is first person. And she goes, it just doesn't fit together. Why have it on there at all? Because it's exciting. No, not good. So I listened to her, and she has guided me well. But it is a terrible process trying to get an agent. Once you get an agent, then things open up, but just getting an agent is tough. And there's people who self-publish, you know, God bless them. I didn't want to do that because there's so much marketing that I can't do on a book. And if you get a publisher of a certain level, they will market it for you, and that helps. And I wanted that. So I was going to keep writing manuscripts until I got an agent. And then, like I said, go back in time and say, I have some other manuscripts you should look at.
Related to that last question, an audience member asked about the mechanics of having an agent. How is the agent compensated?
If you are picked up by an agent who wants money up front, that's not a good agent. You don't want that. The agent gets a percentage of what I get. So it's nice because, you know, it behooves her to get the best deal possible for my book, and to keep on the publisher about, you know, publicizing the book. I was, little sidebar, I was listening to a podcast last night about the publishing industry, and I don't know if these numbers are true, but what they said is in 1999, there were approximately 500,000 books published, available. That seems a little low to me, but let's assume that we're even close to that. And they said right now, there's 29 million books published, because a couple things. Computers. You can now, you know, delete and edit and grammatical checks and spell checks. And people who couldn't, like me before, write a sentence without a grammatical error can now do that. So it became easier to write and edit. And another reason is Amazon has, and other companies have, made it really easy to publish a novel. They have a thing called CreateSpace, where you can pay them like $300. And they will publish your novel for you. So there's all these novels out there that haven't gone through the historical gatekeeping of getting an agent, getting a publisher. They just go out there and put it on Amazon, hope they make $1 million with it. So there's a lot of that out there, and I wanted an agent because it's so hard to push your way through that mass of books. And I figured with an agent, I'll get doors open for a bigger publisher. There are, you know, your top five, top 10 publishers won't even look at you without an agent. I've got a friend, Julie Kramer, who said once that she had an agent. She has a book deal with Simon & Schuster, I think it was Atria, and everything's going fine, but then her agent retired or died. And so she goes back to her publisher and says, I got another book. You ready to publish it? And they said, no, we can't talk to you. You don't have an agent. She goes, but it's me, Julie. You know me. And they said, nope, you got to have an agent. So she went out, got an agent, and then they published her book. It was, that kind of anecdotal evidence is astounding, but they, you know, to get to that level, you have to have an agent. So I was going to keep trying and keep trying until I, you know, found an agent who would, you know, open some doors for some publishers. And it's a tough thing to do. It really is.
Next up, an audience member asked about Eskin's day job as a criminal defense lawyer. Has he ever thought about making writing a full-time career?
I would love to become a full-time writer, but until they start paying me Stephen King money, I'm relegated to having the dual careers. I love my job as an attorney. I do criminal defense. I used to be a prosecutor, but it's, again, more creative to do criminal defense. As a prosecutor, you get the cases handed to you by the cops, and you just simply present it to the court, to the jury, whatever. As a defense attorney, you take that case that the police believe is complete and done, and you try and take it apart. You try and find the flaws. You try and find, you know, alternative ways of looking at things. And it's far more creative than being a prosecutor, and I've done both. So I really enjoy being a criminal defense attorney, but my passion is as a writer. I mean, if I ever could afford to do so, I would have just the one career, I think. Don't tell my law partner that. Oh, this is a podcast. Okay.
Following that question, an audience member asked if Eskin's day-to-day experiences as a lawyer contribute ideas to his writing.
Oh, yeah.
You
know, and that's a very good point. I'm actually, I'm a finalist for the Edgar Allan Poe Award, and I'm going to New York in April for that, but I'm on a panel there which is discussing the day job. And I was trying to think of what I could say about the day job that would be interesting. And the truth is, I get a lot of ideas with my day job. My second novel begins with a car accident where somebody is killed, and a wrongful death attorney takes a look at it and tries to figure out, you know, this person is not who they said they were. That came from a case that I had. I do criminal defense, but I had this one case, this one wrongful death action, because it was a client of mine whose girlfriend died. And as part of the wrongful death, you have to figure out all the family members who could possibly benefit from this lawsuit. So sisters, parents, children. And I started investigating this woman and found out she had kind of a mysterious past. She was given up for adoption at birth, but then she was adopted, and then she was taken back. And I never heard of that. She was taken back to the adoption people, like you're taking a dog back to the pound. It was just kind of weird. And so she grew up in the foster care system. But just the experience of trying to find her roots, I thought, there's fodder for another mystery. That's how the next one can begin. Is someone dies in a car accident, who is it? It's not the person, it's not who they say they are. So yeah, I also have a side gig as an attorney. I come to St. Paul once or twice a month, and I sit on a panel that hears petitions from people who want to get out of the security hospital. And so, in my earlier days as an attorney, I actually did defense work where they would appoint me to go to the security hospital and represent people who wanted to file a petition and get out. And the stories you hear there, I could write them and you would say, nah, that's not true. There's just no way. It's just amazing. I can't talk about them, but the fodder for interesting story ideas is all over my law practice. So, no matter what, I will continue to practice law in some degree, but I would probably scale it back quite a bit if the books do well enough to allow me to do so.
Next up, an audience member asked if Eskin's father was disappointed he didn't end up going into the family business.
Luckily, I have three brothers. I'm the second oldest, but my older brother was not one who was geared towards taking over the business, and my dad knew that. And so when I went away to college, after my second year of college, I was home for the summer, and I was hanging sheetrock to make money to go to college. And he comes up to me and goes, you know, 2 years of college is really enough for anybody. And I said, no, I'm going back. He goes, no, you really, 2 years, you learn as much as you need to know. And he wanted me to come back and take over the company. And I said, no, I respectfully decline. So my next younger brother, he took over the company when he got old enough to do so. But yeah, there was never a concern of mine that the company would drift away. There's enough brothers there, so. And I got two sisters too, but my dad was old school. They was never going to give a drywall company to one of my sisters. So.
The second to last question is about Eskin's work-life balance as a lawyer and a writer. How does he manage his time?
When I'm at the office, I'm an attorney when I'm at the office. I'll do stuff on my drives to court, you know, listen to novels and stuff, and I will edit over my lunch hour, but otherwise I try and keep it. But the first half hour, I'll have coffee, biscotti, and I'll check my emails and stuff, but beyond that, I try and keep it law practice during, you know, 8 to 5. When I get home, I have a very understanding wife, and she allows me to go downstairs, get my laptop out, and type, you know, whatever time I need to type. And up until this past few months, it's worked out very well because, you know, I had this wonderful pattern going. I'd come home and write 1,000 words a day. But since this book came out, I've been spending a lot of time doing stuff like this, which I love, and I'm obsessed with it now. And my wife keeps saying, "Don't you have another novel to write?" Said, yeah, I know. I do, but just got to answer this email real quick, you know. But it's been a blast. I am far enough ahead. I got the next novel outlined. I've got 20,000 words written. I know where it's going to go. Before I type a single word, I have a real thorough outline. I know what's going to happen. It's just a matter of now finding the time to do it. And hopefully my publisher, if it's last minute, he'll work with me. But I'm not too concerned. He knows that I'm doing this stuff.
Finally, an audience member inquires about the criminal justice system and speculates that a lot of criminal defense lawyers come from a prosecutorial background.
Yes. And I've always been of the opinion that a good defense attorney should prosecute and a good prosecutor should do defense work, simply because it's the same game as far as, you know, the chess pieces and the same rules, but it's different perspectives. As a prosecutor, I did not want to know beyond the person's name and the facts of what they did. I didn't want to know who their wife was. I didn't want to know how well they're doing in school. I didn't want to make decisions based on, I like this guy, I don't like this guy. And defense attorneys who never prosecuted would come up to me and say, you know, my guy's a really good guy. You know, he's in college, he's struggling, you know. And I say, but they're all good guys. They're, you know, everybody who gets in trouble has another side of themselves that's good. And they don't see that in order to come to me and get a deal, what they need to do is, here's what's wrong with your case. Now that's what gets my attention as a prosecutor. So as a defense attorney, I know that. I don't go in and say my guy's a good guy because the guy next in line is going to say the same thing. So I try and find flaws with their case, why they don't want to go to trial, you know, and work it that way. And you know, as a defense attorney, I know that. As a prosecutor, I think prosecutors will be more empathetic if they did defense work. They would see that the people they're prosecuting have more facets than just this one crime that they're being prosecuted for. So I do think they should do both sides, but there's no rule, so most people don't. And also most criminal defense attorneys want to be novelists as well.
They're just gathering material.
They are. When I went to that mystery conference in Iowa that one time, just about everybody there was an attorney. It's like, oh, really? I've become a cliche, so. Well, if there are no further questions, I had a great time. I will be here if you have books for me to sign. I love to. Thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. The final episode will feature Linda Lagarde Grover reading from her new novel, The Road Back to Sweetgrass. Until then, we hope you consider supporting the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library and its mission, Stronger Libraries for Stronger Communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. Follow us on Twitter at The Friends and on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl. Please consider subscribing to this podcast on iTunes.